OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/Wall Street.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This is a special episode. We just finished up our annual WSJ Tech DLive conference in Laguna, California, and we have lots of stuff that we'll be talking about for a long time on this show. But if you couldn't be at the conference, this episode is a collection of a few of the most interesting moments. What you're about to hear represents a lot of what we talked about all week, from cyber war to flying cars. So let's jump in. This first segment, a bit from a panel on cybersecurity and cyber warfare with the Journal's global tech editor, Jason Dean, along with Kevin Mandia, the CEO of FireEye, and Shane Huntley, director of the threat analysis group at Google Security. Just so you know, Shane's the one with the Australian accent.
Shane and Kevin, thank you very much for joining us. Your world, cybersecurity, tends to produce a lot of bad news. So let's start with something bad that didn't happen. We had the election, no major cyber attacks to disrupt the election, and seemingly less of a misinformation campaign. What happened or what didn't happen? Shane.
Well, I think you covered it pretty well, that it was significantly different. I was working on this in 2016 and in 2018. And, you know, in terms of what we didn't see this year that we saw in 2016 is we didn't see, you know, people's mailboxes being, you know, hacked and leaked via WikiLeaks and these sort of like active hacking in aid of misinformation. And the real question that's somewhat of the puzzle is why. And in some ways, we got a lot better at defending against this. We got a lot better. But, you know, from my side, we also just didn't see the same level of targeting. And the real, so people are wondering, you know, is it because it's the midterms? But I also think that, you know, this is information operations. So one of the most important things is the battle space that's there. So the population that somebody's trying to influence with these operations, you know, as a country, the US is in a very different place in 2018 there was 2016, so the same tactics aren't going to work. And yeah, it was a lot low-key, so I breathed a sigh of relief and preparations for 2020 started the day after.
Is there a dark lining to this silver cloud, Kevin?
No, I think it's pretty solid. I started a company in 2004 with the premise, let's respond to every security breach that matters. And in 2004, it was an election year, and I can tell you every single election year, when you respond to security breaches, you do get a phone call at some point in time, and you go. So I do think there's a difference between presidential elections and midterm elections, but it's the biggest reason I wear a suit and tie every day, is so that when the phone call comes in, you can speed off to work, and at least you're in a suit and tie. And we got that call in 2004, and I was glad I was in a suit and tie that day, so I could show up and deal with the issues in Washington, D.C. Bottom line on this election is, we saw shields up like never before. I don't know what we can do about the influence operations, but in regards to actually protecting the election systems, I think everybody was watching every packet coming in and out. Everybody was, you know, I know for some of our folks, we were working with other companies, we were working with government agencies, and we were watching everything live. So I didn't see, in fact, what I did see when I got a threat briefing is we saw less than what you normally see in the normal noise on the internet. You know, you're going to get scanned every, you know, few seconds maybe for vulnerabilities if you're just on the internet. And we saw a lot of the systems we were safeguarding get less than that.
Really quickly, what is the number one thing for both of you that you see that people or companies should be doing that they're not to protect themselves?
You know, for individuals, what we see in Gmail is, you know, take the security options that are there, like the two-step verification, you know, even better than having the code that's getting sent to your phone, because I don't trust the phones either, is like the security key or some hardware token. And, you know, these government attackers aren't magical, right? Like, it's not as if there's nothing you can do, and I think that's the biggest, you know, thing that everybody believes, whether companies or whatever, they've got to not believe anymore, is that you can fight back, you can do things. You know, we do see the people that use security keys, use two-factor, patch their machines, do all the basic stuff that everyone actually knows they need to do, and it puts a massive dent in the ability of the attackers to get through.
What percentage of Gmail users use two-factor authentication or two-step verification?
Not nearly enough.
Why don't you make it mandatory?
Because we want to give people the option, for starters, that, you know, we do want to provide it to people who don't want to give us a phone number, people don't want to sign up. We still think you're more secure on Gmail than many of your other options, even if you don't have two-factor. What we do is that if we see you're a target of a state-sponsored or government-backed threat, and we notice about 4,000 Gmail users every month that we believe are targeted by phishing by government-backed threats from all sorts of different governments, we're not picking on any particular one here, we give them a warning saying, you know, we believe you're the target of these threats. And what we do see is that these specific warnings, like this community of people under threat, do have a fairly reasonable take-up of two-factor, and we sort of double or increase the kind of take-up by another 50% by giving them these sort of warnings. So we do try and really focus on the users who need it the most, and I think we're having some good success there.
Do you want to tell us, what do you see as the number one thing?
If I were CEO of a company, I would want unvarnished truth about our cybersecurity. I would do what's called a red team. I'd pick things that are unacceptable to your organization, like somebody hacking in and stealing the CEO's email, or someone hacking in and getting to an industrial control system, or someone breaking in, stealing customer data, and I would test it. Your chief information security officer or director of IT or whatever you have reporting to you on security, they mean well, but they can't win. If they come to you with a report saying, you know, here we are and we're all in the green, you shouldn't trust that answer. If they say, here we are in cybersecurity and everything's in the red, you should be upset, like, why the heck are we in the red? And if they give you something that's in the yellow, you're wondering, well, how good are we? I'm confused and you don't know how to feel as a CEO. Red team your networks to see if some third party from outside the network can make a threat become a reality that you don't want to live through. And I think that'll tell you unvarnished truth as to the state of your security program. And I hope everybody knows what red team means. That's, you know, hacking drill, penetration test, to have a specific outcome.
And next, Gwyneth Paltrow, who you've probably heard of because she's Gwyneth Paltrow. She chatted with WSJ Magazine's Elisa Lipsky-Karas about her company, Goop, and her transition from actor to businessperson.
Well, this is funny. Normally, you're running the conferences. This is a little different than in Goop Health. So you've had a crazy fall. You wedged in a wedding and a honeymoon in between opening two new Goop stores, expanding to Europe, launching a bunch of new products, including what must be the best name for a supplement ever, Madame Ovary. And London, that was your first store in Europe.
Yes. Yeah. We opened London in the beginning of October, which is really... it was a great moment for me because I founded not the company, but I started sending newsletters out of my kitchen in London 10 years ago. And so to be able to come home and put a nice brand presence there and turn on e-commerce there, it was great.
Yeah. And that was, you used MailChimp, right?
To send back out in the day, yes, yeah. Back in the day.
And the first one was turkey ragu, banana nut muffins, right?
Yep. Some recipes on MailChimp and trying to figure out WordPress by myself. It was not very good.
But so take us back, what were you thinking when you did that?
You know, that's sort of the question I ask myself a lot. I think what had happened was essentially I had a lot of luck with my film career, and it was, it went very smoothly and I had a lot of success very quickly. And, you know, and at some point I think I had a little bit of a philosophical crisis, and I had my first child and I kind of stopped and I had to ask myself if a film career was really what I wanted to do. And I think I had a lot of confusion around it and almost shame around even allowing myself to ask myself that question, you know, and I had no idea what that would do to my identity if I wasn't that. And it was a complicated process, but I harbored this very real passion that I wanted to start some kind of digital lifestyle business, and I had no idea how to do it or how to start. And I had
this was before Instagram.
This was before Instagram.
It was 10 years ago, not 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so I just very, I think with a lot of fear and hesitation, I just started sending out content. And I did that for 6 years before I even thought about monetizing the business or how I would do it. And I think what occurred is that I unwittingly created this audience and a lot of trust. And that's really the foundation of the business as it exists today.
And so what was the sort of like aha moment when you realized that you were actually being taken seriously as a founder?
I don't know. Am I? I mean, I think it was very incremental. It happened in slow steps. And I think, you know, you start and you have this idea and then you try to raise money and, you know, you go through that whole process. And, you know, I think that the metrics by which people judge you are pretty binary and clear. Mm-hmm. And I think once you start to hit those metrics, then people start to take you seriously.
And what sort of metrics are you referring to there?
You know, like if you have a lot of organic growth, if you have a good CAC to LTV ratio, stuff like that, like just undeniable metrics. So when you're, you know, people say, oh, okay, well, this is a big audience and, you know, you're, there's real revenue here and your unit economics are strong. And then I think people start to take you seriously, but it took a long time, you know, and to be an actress and to be in these rooms with VCs and trying to articulate my vision and, you know, it takes a long time to learn how to do it and learn all the acronyms and all that.
Okay, coming up, more of our favorite stuff from the DLive conference in Laguna.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
Up now, a few minutes from a panel with the Journal's business editor, Jamie Heller, talking to Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong and Wall Street veteran Zoe Cruz about the potential and problems with cryptocurrency.
Brian, Zoe, thank you so much for being here. Hello, everybody. Tough year for cryptocurrencies, Brian, and you run one of the biggest exchanges. How are you holding up?
Well, I've been in cryptocurrency about 7 years now, and it keeps going through these cycles where you have a major run-up in the price, and then it corrects down a little bit, but it's at a new plateau. And it seems to keep doing that every couple of years. And so this last run-up that happened in 2017 and then the correction was not really unexpected for us. I think that every time it has that big run-up, there's a whole new wave of people out there who figure out about, you know, find out about cryptocurrency and get involved in it. And so when it corrects back, I actually like those periods a little bit better because during the bubbles, it kind of, all these people rush in who are trying to do some get-rich-quick business or something. And in the correction periods, it gives us a chance to just put our head down, keep building good products, and help the company go forward and prepare for the next wave of adoption. So that's how it's been in the last year so far.
Zoe, you've also been in this business for around a year or so. Also came into the board of Ripple, which is an enterprise technology company that also owns XRP currency. Mm-hmm. And you also came in kind of at the top. And so a year later, are you more bullish or bearish on the whole enterprise?
So I am much more bullish on the whole ecosystem.
Okay.
I think anyone who will tell you where XRP or Bitcoin or any of these things are going to go next is, your judgment is as good as theirs, frankly. But I think crypto assets are going to be a very meaningful part of the way we do things. And blockchain technology, it sounds like sound bites, but I do believe that. I went from when I got the call from the headhunter say, I'm not interested, to actually the more I read, you go into this vortex of the more you read, the more you need to read, where I feel this is something very big.
But what is this very big? I mean, that's been talked about, very big, very big, very big, but where's the proof? What is it?
It's a fair question. So people conflate a lot of things, and there are a lot of false prophets out there, frankly, but blockchain technology is something that actually will revolutionize a lot of processes, a lot of things. And I mean, all of us read some of those things, candidates. The digital currency XRP in this case, Bitcoin, or any of those crypto assets, you need to truly revolutionize the payment system. And when I used to call both my old firm, Morgan Stanley, to say I've joined the board of Ripple, and can they educate me as to how they view that world, and what Morgan Stanley and others would say, what problem are you solving? And actually, the cross-border payment problem. I mean, there are different problems you would be solving with different applications, and that's why I think you can't get into religious discussions where it's either Bitcoin or XRP or Ethereum. There will be room for 10, 20 different cryptocurrencies that will actually serve different needs.
So what are the companies that are either going to be your like friend or foe in the future that we're not even really deeply thinking about right now? Like, where do Google and Facebook fit in? Are they going to be like your partner in the future, or are you going to overtake them in some way? Where do you see those?
Yeah, it's not really how I think about it. So I think if you look at the big tech companies and the big financial service companies, I think, you know, in 5 or 10 years, almost all of them will have some kind of blockchain initiative, because it's going to be like saying, are you an internet company? It's like every company uses the internet today, right? I think also in 10 years, you're going to have a bunch of startups. Probably at least 50% of startups in 5 or 10 years will actually be created where they raise money using a token, a cryptocurrency, if you will. This is a big shift that's happening right now away from, you know, the traditional model, which was raise a seed round, you know, do your Series A, Series B, Series C. Someday maybe you go public and you trade on the public stock exchanges. What's happening now is that companies are actually issuing a token, raising money either from people all over the world or from accredited investors in some cases, depends what country you're in. And then they're kind of like public from day one, and they're tokenizing their cap table. They're going to go public on the blockchain. So this is like stock market 2.0.
And by the way, this is not ICOs or?
So ICOs were the first iteration of this.
Okay.
And it was really kind of the Wild West, right? It's like you had all these people raising money for things, which some of them were total scams, right? And it really kind of got out of hand. But underlying ICOs, there's a fundamental innovation, which is that you don't have to be in Silicon Valley now to raise money from venture capitalists. If you live in, you know, Bangalore or wherever it is, and you have a great idea, you can post your idea on the internet, and people all over the world can, you know, invest in your company. It's a little bit like crowdfunding, but in this case, you actually get equity in the company, or, you know, tokens, tokenize the cap table. You get tokens in the company. That's a really big innovation because it means anybody in the world who has a good idea can raise money. You don't have to live in Silicon Valley.
I would say in this new industry, intelligent regulation, the industry has to get ahead of it. Because if there is a collapse where the retail or the individual gets hurt, then you're going to have unintelligent regulation.
Next up, dating apps. One in particular, actually, Bumble, which has always been a little different from other dating apps, but is working on some things that make it even more so. This is Whitney Wolfe Herd talking to the Journal's Nikki Waller.
You helped Tinder and later Bumble grow by getting adoption on college campuses. What's the secret to getting viral adoption on college campuses? I think a lot of the people here want to know.
So we really thought about human behavior. Okay, so technology should not completely alter the reality of someone's lifestyle. It should just give access. It should give you measure beyond these walls. And if you think about a college campus, highly social, very dense ecosystem, and the majority of people are looking for the same thing. So you're not entering this crowded street where you have a lot of families walking down the street and then some single 18-year-olds. College campuses, you can bet that the majority are looking for the same thing. And so if they'd been reliant on meeting one another at the Friday night party or at a fraternity event, this is restrictive. And so going in and really changing the mood, changing the brand, and repackaging something that every human on the planet needs to do, connect, date, right, find friends, this is a no-brainer. And really, quite frankly, it's very hard to engineer the network effect. That's why you only have a handful of popular social platforms in the world.
I did want to ask about Bumble Business. So I've been spending some time on Bumble. And how is it going to, what is coming out that's going to match me a little bit better?
So you'll be able to filter what you're looking for. You want to meet somebody that works in sales, or you want to meet somebody that works in consumer tech. You'll be able to search people based on industry.
Will you be able to do that for dating too?
That's coming.
Can I filter journalists out of my...
No, not by occupation. We can offline about that. Right. There might be a way to do that. Dating, you'll be able to filter on a bevy of kind of, you know, credentials. And same for friend finding. So if you're looking for a roommate, you can filter for people looking just for a roommate. If you're looking for someone to go work out with, you can filter just for somebody looking to go work out with. A lot of women are just looking for female co-founders or female team members or new employees. So it fosters this, you know, kind of empowered ecosystem that we've launched with and we've carried through throughout.
And last, but not least, flying cars. Our own Christopher Mims talked with Rodin Liasov, the CEO of A-Cubed by Airbus, about what the world of flying cars might look like and why it might be sooner than you think.
So autonomy has proven to be very challenging in cars. What can we expect from planes, where it seems like the stakes are higher?
Yeah, we can expect
more
it to be challenging.
More challenging, less challenging?
Different challenging. I mean, we can get buried in the details. I'll try not to do that. Cars have to solve a fundamentally different problem. So the core technologies for navigating aircraft in the sky have actually not relied on machine vision. I mean, like 90% of your flights, most of you probably flew here, 90% of your flights were probably automated. We can do automated landing at most airports with most aircraft. Taxi is still a problem, but mostly because we haven't tried. But the machine vision stuff that cars require because of the cluttered and unstructured environment they operate in is different. So a lot of
there's no pedestrians or cyclists in the sky.
So if you zoom out just one more level, so in the sky, we already have a very deterministic set of flight rules that govern how aircraft navigate, and how they avoid oncoming traffic.
So you mean the FAA's rules about just how you have to travel?
Yeah, the FAA has rules about how you actually negotiate the sky. And so that the airspace, the environment, is a lot more structured and almost algorithmic. You can actually code up what an aircraft's supposed to do when they encounter anything. We have air traffic control that actually is quite effective at maintaining separation between aircraft. And generally, if you file a flight plan and you say, I'm coming from here to there and I'm going along this route, they can tell you that that route will be deconflicted. And there's a lot of automation you can add there to make that process more scalable. And so the things that cars are developing today, the machine vision and obstacle avoidance, that is like the last line of defense, not the first line of defense. Like in a well-structured, well-managed environment, you may never need that system to do anything. Now,
because you know where these things are in the sky already, they have beacons on them or whatever, and you just
so there's ADS-B. So more aircraft are going to have ADS-B, which means they'll announce their location, and so that problem, the deconfliction, is easier. And
do
also,
we need a significant change to how we do air traffic control now? We're going to do that for decades.
I think structurally probably not, but in terms of adding intelligence and automation to allow it to scale better, I think yes. But I don't think we need to rewrite the flight rules at all. I think the flight rules are great.
So to return to this vision, 5-10 years from now, hopefully, when we're dodging Los Angeles traffic by just like hopping from one side of the city to the other. I mean, are we talking, you know, hundreds of flights a day, thousands potentially? I mean, I know there are limits in terms of the airspace, but what kind of density are we talking about?
I think hundreds is very plausible. I think thousands is doable. Yep. We won't know until
one large city, thousands.
Yeah, one large city.
Yep.
It depends on the infrastructure.
So we're going to get used to these things whizzing over our heads at some point.
Well, ours is almost an audible overhead. And so you actually won't be a whiz. They'll be loud when they take off. But after that, they're actually quite quiet. Look, we're going to do this. We're going to do this safely. And I think the capacity will be determined by the safety requirements for the airspace and the number of touchdown points or vertiports, if you will.
And speaking of safety, of course, we already accept you know, what autonomous driving advocates would say is a totally unacceptable number of fatalities every year on our roads, in our human-piloted cars, any new means of transportation. There is a trade-off in that, you know, like, that there will be failures, people are going to die. Are you at all concerned about what I think of as, like, that Uber moment where they, you know, through their own inattention, became, you know, the first company to kill someone with an autonomous vehicle? Are you worried about what that moment looks like in autonomous flight? Because it's going to come. I mean, we have to accept that.
Of course I'm worried. Of course I'm worried. But at the same time, just recognize that airspace regulations, and that's why we're talking about the certification levels, and certification is not just about the aircraft, it's also about the entire system that the aircraft operates in. Mm-hmm. Those standards are very high, and they're well understood, and they've existed for years, and we are operating within those standards. We're not...
The existing standards.
We're not
saying
whatever...
You're not trying to demand a new carve-out like some people are for...
We are operating... No, we're operating within those standards, and those are standards... They're not just regulations that constrain what we do. There are regulations that tell us how to do something safely, and they work. And I firmly believe that they work. And you just think of them as, you know, experts that tell you how to keep people safe.
By the way, do you think you're going to end up competing for airspace with the drone delivery companies?
So part of me hopes so, because that means we've achieved the particular unlocking of the ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, I think... I mean, a very specific answer is no, because I think that our altitude requirements are different. And I think that there will be clearly delineated crossing of airspaces mm-hmm. for the different aircraft. And I think there will be clear priorities which exist today. Today, air traffic controllers decide who gets priority. So emergency vehicles are first, a large commercial get a higher priority than like hobbyist drones, right? And so if you call the tower and say, I want to fly near the airport for whatever purpose, if they're busy and there's a lot of aircraft coming in, they'll say, thank you, but no. And so I think that will all get codified and, again, with a high degree of automation, just get implemented into the airspace. And precedents exist, right? We're not reinventing all of that. It's just adding additional kind of guidelines and regulations.
So best case scenario, I arrive at LaGuardia and my burrito arrives right behind me on a drone, and it's all Uber, right?
If that's what you care
about. It's Uber flight and Uber Eats.
I'm not going to comment on that. That maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not concerned about burrito deliveries.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Okay. Well, that's what I was told.
I think there's probably easier ways
burritos
to get your burrito at LaGuardia than a drone.
The optimal form factor for drone delivery.
Yeah. I mean, they burst easily with hard line. I don't think you need a drone.
We're not talking about bombing.
I don't think you need a drone to get a burrito at LaGuardia. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. We'll see who's right. We'll check the receipts.
All right.
That's it for Instant Message from Laguna, though we have lots more coverage, videos, and podcasts from the conference at WSJ.com. We'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming next week. And in the meantime, you can subscribe to Instant Message on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen. We'll talk to you next week.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day, but what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.